Hello, this is Growing Wild. I am Charlotte Petz and you are listening to Radio Reverb on 97.2 FM, online and on digital. On this month's show, we have the editor of new magazine Bloom. We also have author and creator of Wild Patience, Tanya Shadrick, and also wild swimmer and writer Ella Foote. But first, let's have a song. And if any of you have ever watched Juno, then you'll recognise this song, and it's All I Ever Want Is You.
If I was a flower growing wild and free, all I'd want is you to be my sweet honeybee. And if I was a tree growing tall and green, all I'd want is you to shade me and be my leaves. If I was a flower growing wild and free, all I'd want is you to be my sweet honeybee. And if I was a tree growing tall and green, all I'd want is you to shade me and be my leaves. All I want is you, will you be my bride? Take me by the hand and stand by my side. All I want is you, will you stay with me? Hold me in your arms and sway me like the sea.
That's All I Want Is You by Barry Louis Polisar. Okay, so first up, we have Zina Alkayat. I really hope I've said that right. She is the editor-in-chief at a new magazine, which is called Bloom. And issue one just came out about a month or so ago. It's a beautiful thing. It's wonderfully illustrated. It's just one of those things that you like the fact that you own it. And I really wanted to have a chat with them because it seems like they're kind of almost the printed version of this show. They're exploring themes, you know, about gardening, about nature, about encouraging people to get outside, and interesting folk that are doing things in and around the country. So I caught up with Zina, and I started off by asking her how this magazine came about.
I was incredibly fortunate to be able to buy a small property in London, and it came with a small garden. And it was that kind of... I felt kind of frozen for a little while with it because I knew I wanted to get out there and just, you know, give it a go and transform it. But I didn't really know how. And you sort of find yourself going into black holes online, like trying to find the right advice, and you're kind of Googling certain terms and then ending up on Pinterest. And it's very overwhelming, actually, to just how it's like an assault of information. And then there's some, you know, obviously Garden as well is absolutely brilliant. The RHS is amazing. And those resources are, we're so fortunate to have them, but they're not terribly accessible for people who have no idea what they're doing. And I think because I'm so used to, in journalism, like sort of finding an angle, finding a story, and in publishing, I've been making books for the last sort of 5 years, you know, finding that gap in the market or knowing what an audience needs or wants, what's missing, what kind of information isn't out there for people in the right kind of style. So it seemed just bizarre to me that there wasn't a magazine that spoke to people in this situation, that kind of gave them practical advice, but also kind of interesting stories and inspiration. So I thought, well, actually, I can do this. And I also know brilliant people who would love to do this with me. We've just got a really incredible team. And Sarah Pike is the art director, and she's designed just so many beautiful books. And she's now kind of woven her magic through Bloom. And she's just brought such a beautiful aesthetic to it, which I think is kind of that balance between independent, kind of beautifully crafted, and also accessible, like newsstand style magazine. And then we've got Laura Nicholson, who has also got a publishing background and has studied horticulture as well. And she just brings this brilliant kind of enthusiasm and amazing kind of practical sense of like what people want to have a go at or try. And she's got really brilliant ideas about how to encourage people to just give things a go. So yeah, between the three of us, we've kind of got it covered. And I think like all of our influences in this, and it's come out beautifully, I think. I hope.
I think so. It's lovely. It's only been issue one so far, so it's going well.
Yeah, it's going brilliantly. Oh, like, good. Like Touchwood's just been, the feedback's been incredible. Like I say, I think it was just, there was something missing and it's just kind of come and stepped into that gap. But, and with everyone kind of suddenly kind of appreciating nature more, wanting to be part of it and perhaps not always knowing how, it seems well timed as well.
Yeah, very much so. Is it quite difficult to get something like this off the ground?
Yes, in some ways.
To sort of find your way into the market and get your name known. I imagine that's a fairly difficult thing.
Yeah, there's a lot to learn. It's a real steep learning curve. But because independent magazines in general has been growing as an area, it's perhaps slightly more straightforward than it would have been 5 or 10 years ago. So I think one of the biggest challenges was just finding a printer that, you know, I connected with and that I could work with, and understanding all the costs involved in that and the logistics, and then understanding how you move magazines around the country and get them into stores. And, you know, there's been a lot of elements that obviously we haven't had experience in and that I've had to learn very quickly, but that's part of the challenge. And actually it's been a real joy. Most of the kind of fun has been speaking to people in the gardening world and like discovering new stories. That's been incredible. The feedback from readers has also been amazing, to kind of connect with them and learn more about what they're enjoying and what they want to see more of. And then just on a personal level, trying to launch a magazine and run a business and hold down a job and kind of balance all of that has just been a really incredible kind of experience.
Yeah, sounds busy.
Yeah. Very.
So where do you get your ideas for content? It sounds like you're going to allow that to be fairly reader-led.
When we first sort of sat down and looked at how to flat plan it, I think we knew we wanted a balance between kind of seasonal information and kind of inspiration, practical projects, things that you can actually go and do and kind of learn about. And then a sort of features section that has stories that brings kind of new voices in or talks about a subject that that is interesting us. And I mean, the one that I really love that Laura did in this one is Aromatic Botanic, which looks at perfumed flowers and using your sense of smell in the garden and how it's not just about roses. I mean, that was really a lovely feature. And then through the back, just really classic kind of magazine content, like shopping page and, you know, places to go, things to do, you know, areas to explore, little Q&As. So, I mean, it sort of shapes itself once you kind of think, oh, we want a bit of this and a bit of that. And, oh, isn't that an exciting story? And, oh, have you heard of this person? And, oh, I saw this amazing kind of shop that's doing this incredible thing. Then it all just sort of slots in. So it's a lot of conversations between me, Sarah and Laura. And then social media obviously fuels a lot of content because you discover so many things that you wouldn't know about otherwise. Mm. So it's a real kind of medley of where the ideas come from.
Yeah. It's a bit like this, actually. It's a bit like this show, kind of.
I actually thought that when I was like listening back to some of your earlier ones. Okay. I was like, it is like that something must have triggered where you're like, oh, I'm really interested in the sea right now, like, okay. And then you sort of from there, like, you start to find like interesting people and things that are happening that, you know, you just need to scratch the surface and it's all going on.
Yeah.
And it's just like bringing it out and like introducing that to a wider audience.
Yeah.
And they're as excited as you are. I mean, I'm like excited daily by the things I find out about, and it's like, okay, how do we cram all of this in? It's just, yeah, it's a really like dynamic industry and kind of area, and loads of young people are doing really interesting things.
Yeah. Do you feel like by writing about these things that that's sort of your contribution towards helping people engage in nature? Because, you know, we do have a huge problem. We've had all these reports out about climate change, and we can all feel a little bit kind of useless because we don't know how to help and what to do. Does this in some way give you an outlet for that, and does it feel like it's your way of contributing to helping that situation?
Yeah, I think that's like very accurate. We all have to look at the skills we have. We all have to look at the resources that are available to us and how to utilize those, how to put those to the best use, not just personally, but for a wider community and our place in the world. So yes, there could have been 10 different magazines we could have created, or I could have thought of or put out into the world, but this one just seemed quite vital. And I hope that there is a bit of a sense of politics in there. I mean, we've got Sarah Limbeck talking about how planting food is actually a sort of act of activism, because it's so democratic that you can take a kind of community plot and start growing veg on it, and suddenly you've got something that, you know, is a focus for the community, that sort of feeding people. I mean, it's an incredibly powerful thing, and we can't underestimate that. And I wrote another feature in here that was about an incredible artist called Liz Davis, who has sort of dedicated her life to preserving wild nature in the city. And that's sort of weeds and plants that grow on bomb sites and things. And they're all pressed and documented in the Natural History Museum. And I'm not going to do her justice talking about it now, but if you read the article or look into her work, you'll just see how one person's passion can actually kind of influence so many people. And if all we can do is bring those stories to the surface, if we can get, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 people to read those and feel inspired by them, and then to look at what they can do, then that's incredible. That would be like, that's just such a brilliant thing to be able to do.
That was Zina Alkayet from the new magazine Bloom. You can find out more about that magazine online on bloommag.co.uk. The first issue has just come out, and it is really lovely. It feels quite different, and it applies to a bit of a different market to usual with these types of things. So the general theme that's running through this show is a couple of things, and it's people who are writing and find that that's their contribution to getting people outside and connecting with nature. And also with these three women, they all just followed their curiosity and realised the thing they were interested in and have followed the thread and seen where it leads them. And I found that particularly so with Tanya Shadrick, who's coming up next. But let's have a song first, and it's going to be She's a Rainbow by the Rolling Stones. That was She's a Rainbow by the Rolling Stones. So next up we have Tanya Shadrick. I actually asked Tanya to be on the show such a long time ago, like 16 months ago or something, and I just never heard back. So that occasionally happens. You'll be surprised to hear, but it does sometimes happen. And then I went to an event at Charleston Farmhouse and I saw her there. So I just thought, oh, I'll just go and say hi. And I introduced myself, and it turned out that literally that day she just read the message that I'd sent, because I did it via Instagram. So she knew who I was, and she's like, no way, I've literally just read the message where you invited me on the show over a year ago. So it was this nice little serendipitous moment, and then I asked her to be on it again, and now she has, which is great news. Tanya created a project called Wild Patience, which was basically her sitting by the side of Pell's Pool in Lewes, the outdoor pool, and just writing. And she explains more about that project and a lot better than I can, and what that project has now led to, and how her life has changed just from that one action that she took in doing that project. So I went to Tanya's house and we were sitting at her writing desk and I asked her to explain a little more about the project called Wild Patients.
The Wild Patient scrolls, there are five of them. It's a mile of writing, and the scrolls are each the length of the country's oldest outdoor pool, which is Pell's Pool in Lewes. And so it was a site-specific piece in the sense that the dimensions of the rolls came because I was working by a swimming pool. But the concept of Wild Patients I'd been carrying around in my head for a long time, this idea of effort and slowness, because although I'm quick mentally, my other rhythms are quite slow, and that's what I prize in life. I prize quite values that don't seem very fashionable, things like patience and persistence and rigour and, you know, effort. Those are words that mean a lot to me, and I wanted to find a way to bring those ideas to other people. It created lots of conversation, just me working away quietly on the edge of the day.
What were you writing?
So a lot of people asked whether it was therefore a stream of consciousness, because they are so huge, and you know, it's 100,000 words by the time I finished it, but actually it was the opposite of what we imagine by stream of consciousness. You know, in a sense, yes, I was arriving every day and talking about the here and now, and sometimes I'm just doodling, but then other times it's really quite serious writing that with only a small amount of editing can get published as discrete pieces. And because it was so long, and of course I was always rolling it away from myself, I couldn't see what I had just written because of the length of the table. It actually meant I had to use a lot of really, there's a lot of grammar in it. It's almost like musical notation. There's lots of dashes, long dashes, semicolons, colons, because I had to keep, you know, I had to keep form to it. Yeah. It would be just mush otherwise if it was just endless long sentences.
Yeah. And why a pool? Why did you choose Pell's?
Because I was looking back through old notebooks, actually, and for about 2 years in my very tiny notebooks, and so it's from one extreme to another, I had these tiny little pocket reporter books that I carried around for 2 or 3 years. And I'd already begun to go, look, how can I take this private practice of mine and share it with people? Maybe I'll just kneel down, because I used to sit in the Grange Gardens in Lewes Lot in a lot of public parks and shopping precincts. And I thought maybe I'll just do it in public like buskers do. I'll just kind of kneel down in a shopping precinct, or I'll kneel down in some public gardens. So the idea had been there for a long time. But then I suddenly thought, God, this pool I go to all the time, that's actually the perfect place, because people in it have already signed up for being out of their normal lives for a short while. Mm-hmm. It's a really great place to surprise a real cross-section of people.
Mm. So you said about busking. You're hoping to engage people with you then, because some writers it's very solitary and you don't want to be interrupted, because then, oh, where's that sentence gone? But it sounds like you wanted the interaction with people, and that was kind of the point.
Yeah, and that's a really big thing behind it for me. So I had a very classical education in English. I come from a very working class rural background, not many books growing up, but then my undergraduate education was proper classical English literature training, okay? And I got a first, you know, I was very steeped in novels and literature. And a normal path would have been to go into the arts, and I did work in TV for a while and then rejected it. And I think it was because it matters to me so much, books and how to live, the way that you can learn how to live. We only get one life, but if we read lots of books, we can live many lives and many times, many cultures, many gender. I just got stuck with this idea that maybe because of the working class background I come from, particularly back then, a lot of people don't buy books, they don't come across certain types of books. And so, I don't know, just to become a normal novelist, there was something in me that stopped at that. I thought, that's writing books maybe for people that will always find those ideas anyway. And so that was just a problem I carried around for years. Mm. And then this sort of solved it. I thought, oh, this is a really great way to make writing a more generous art. Because usually by the time you read a writer's work, they've written it in private, they've edited it, it's been copy edited, it's been typeset, proofed. And I thought, you know, musicians play, the stakes are really high. If they go wrong on stage, everybody sees it. They often don't, because they've trained so hard, but so have I. I've trained for years in writing and reading. Mm. It's about time to see what I can do with that.
What are you hoping to do, if anything, with the scrolls? Or was it just that the project existed within itself and that's the bit that mattered, and now it doesn't really matter what happens to the work?
I said that I'm not a Buddhist by any means. I don't have any kind of religious practice, but all along I did feel that it was about the here and now. And then one woman I didn't know said to me one day, well, so this seems like a real thing about non-attachment, so are you just going to burn them afterwards? And this thing in me just went, oh, they're my children. I, you know, if you pick one up and inherit, they feel like small babies. They feel about the same weight as my children did when they were very young babies, and they could just sit on your hip.
Yeah.
And I love the feel of them, and materially I like to, you know, they're my precious. So it, that was good, in that it told me that I like the fact they still exist. But it is also true to say I didn't go into it. I certainly didn't think they would change my life as much as they had. I didn't think it would be of interest to anybody outside of Lewis. So that was extraordinary, that it has unlocked a kind of minor public life for me, and I always wanted that, so that's good. But at the minute, I'm not actively trying to get them displayed because there's some really private stuff in there.
Right.
You know, they are, I have often described them as well as like pillow books. You know, they're physically the shape of pillows.
Yeah.
And although I was writing in public, it was also quite private, because if somebody came along and I was on a very private bit, it was the work of seconds to roll it away so you could then see a more publicly acceptable. So there's a lot of really raw stuff in there. So I need to be cautious with that. There's a, yeah, I think it'll have its time. If it happens, it happens. But I certainly want to keep them.
And how has it changed? Well, I guess how has it changed your life? It was a big chunk of your life, 2 years, and something that you hadn't done before. What's come from the experience?
Well, I use the word a public life because that, to me, is the real difference. It's not about being published and not published, which is what I always thought. As someone who wanted to be a writer, I always thought that life was divided between pre-publication and post-publication. You know, don't look different now. And actually, it's not that. It's more about private life versus a public life, having a voice in the world, however minor and modest. And I think Ted Hughes talked about, I wish I knew it off by heart, but he said something about people think they want to be known, but the effect on, and this, he's talking before online media, okay, and he's talking back in the 60s, 70s about this, and he said, it's you can't understand it if you've not been, even being named in the local paper for something significant. He said it almost has it affects your metabolism. It's like an allergic effect. It's a really big deal. And it's a thing most people think they want, but once you're on that, and you can't ever go back. And I think that's true. You know, there's pictures of me on the internet, the kids looking up in school with their friends whenever they're doing like an IT lesson about, you know, social media. It's like, look at girl's mum. No, it's... But that's also why I do it, because it's the connections, and that's why I do what I do. And like every time I go and give a talk, it's not about how many people come, it's about there's always a chance on that night that I'll meet somebody who changes the course of my life, even in a minor way, or that I meet someone who has need of hearing me, or that, as often happens, it's more, you know, as when you and I met, it's more a two-way thing. And pretty much there's not a single event I've done where that didn't happen, where it wasn't worth going.
So I want to move on to the latest project you've been involved with, which is Wild Woman Swimming?
Wild Woman Swimming, yeah.
About Lynn Roper.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite a story.
So that's another example of once you start something, people start to find you. So it was my first year at PELS 2016. I was only about a month into it. I wrote a very short blog post about what I call self-sovereignty, the last time I'd felt really at home in my skin and full of power as a woman. And it was when I was a nine-year-old girl at the sea in Widmouth in Cornwall, where I grew up. And, you know, it wasn't my first blog post, but it was the first sort of literary one. And I published it thinking, well, I have got hardly any Twitter followers and nobody follows my blog, so this is all a bit stupid. And then this woman got in touch, and she was a really well-known wild swimmer. She was not one of the founders of the Outdoor Swimming Society, but was joined them very early on, was there for the founding of the Devon and Cornwall Wild Swimmers. And she said, you know, I'm a really well-known wild swimmer. So anyway, to begin with, she just in May, she just liked my work. But then a few weeks later, got in touch to say, I've seen on your website that you've worked as a hospice scribe. Like, I'm a paramedic and I know I'm dying. And in the 5 years since I recovered from breast cancer, I've become this wild swimmer. And I've been keeping a swim diary, but I'm too ill now. to even edit it. And I managed to get down and see her just for 3 hours in July 2016, and she died a month later. And at that point, I'd only read a couple of the entries, so it was a really big risk. But something in me told, I just went, I think she's the real thing. I think the rest of her writing will be good. I set up my own press to publish it, because I tried to interest some publishers and agents and I didn't really get anywhere. I had some interest, everybody replied, so that was pretty good, but nobody was going to take it on, so yeah, I did it myself. And then you meet more people, so on it goes, you know, it's just, yeah.
Are you a wild swimmer?
No. And that's the really extraordinary thing, which I love, is that, and I never pretended I was, so I wrote about being in the sea, but I wasn't a swimmer. We were discouraged from swimming, actually, because it's such a difficult bit of the coast, and we all have these homemade wooden surfboards that you belly board with. It's a real Cornish thing. And we were always encouraged not to get out of our depth because of the rip currents, even though there were lifeguards on the beach. So cold water, yes, being outdoors by water, absolutely. But swimming in it, no. I can swim, but I'm not a wild swimmer. But what I love is that I've now got these people, like Carrie Fury. She's one of the founders of the Outdoor Swimming Society, and she's also a really renowned coach, swimming coach.
I've met her, yeah.
Have you? Yeah. And, you know, I know that she would teach me to swim properly. And then, you know, there's these men and women all around the country, and actually in other countries, that if I contacted them now because of the book,
They would take
me into water and keep me safe, and that's really exciting.
Your work is very, it seems to be very nature-based, and that seems to be a big part of you. Is there some of you that hopes that when people engage with your work, it will also help them engage with what you're writing about, with nature and with swimming? You know, is that part of your agenda? You want to try and just nudge people out and say...
Because I think, particularly in the modern age, I think it's so easy to live a two-dimensional life and not live a first-hand life or a three-dimensional life. And I think however low we are or lost we are, and I was really lost back in 2012 when I had to leave a job I thought I'd stay until I retired. I became really ill then, and at first I was hiding in the house because I was on paid sick leave, and I remember just reading, and then I began to sit on park benches, and that was the path. At first it's just birds, it wasn't people, it was just animals, it was just things that came close, it was just learning particular trees in different seasons. And I just feel strongly that we need to let the world in. I'm not mystical, I'm not saying the birds are talking to us or that the world has a plan for each of us, but I'm saying that by putting ourselves out in public and away from our peers and away from all of our props, we let the world teach us.
That's Tana Shadrick there. That book that she was talking about that she's just finished and was released, I think, in September, is called Wild Woman Swimming and has done incredibly well. And I think is now a top 10 bestseller at Waterstones. And, you know, it's been endorsed by the Outdoor Swimming Society and all sorts. So it's such a great story. And you just don't know where life will take you once you start doing something. That interview was about 45 minutes long and was so difficult to get down to 10. I'm really tempted actually to put it out as a separate thing just for the podcast listeners as its own entity, because it was such a great conversation. You can find Tanya on Twitter. She's most prolific on Twitter, which is at Lido Writers. Actually, her and my next guest, Ella Foote, are doing an event together at Kendall Mountain Festival. So if you find yourself up that way, then you can hear them chatting together, and I bet that's just going to be brilliant. Okay, let's have a song, and then we will hear from Ella, who is also a writer, but this time is actually a wild swimmer too. This is Cotton Jones and Somehow to Keep It Going. That was Somehow to Keep It Going by Cotton Jones. You're listening to Growing Wild here on Radio Reverb. I am Charlotte Petz, And next up, we have writer and swimmer Ella Foote. Now, Ella first came to my attention via the Outdoor Swimming Society and coverage of Dipper Day December, where she swam every day last December, funnily enough, as the title may suggest. And it was picked up by all sorts of people, and there's this excellent photo of her in black and white trousers skipping off down the river, and it's just snowy everywhere, and she's in a bobble hat, and couldn't be happier. Her latest project was a trip across Scotland, swimming sort of three or four times a day in various lochs and rivers in the sea. And she made hilarious videos on Instagram stories, and I was just sort of hooked on watching those and keeping up with the adventures. She writes and interviews for all sorts of different swimming magazines, and she affectionately calls those interviews swimterviews. And so I thought it'd be lovely to meet up with her, and she came down to Brighton. We went for a swim. It was sunrise. It was glorious. It was a very beautiful sky. I mean, I didn't stay in for that long. She's way hardier than me. We had this lovely swim, came out, sat on the beach and chatted for a long time. I went a bit blue, got claw hand from holding the microphone, and very much needed a hot drink afterwards. So I started with wanting to know more about how she got into outdoor swimming in the first place.
So I swam in the sea as a child in Britain, which I thought everyone was doing. I thought it was like part of growing up. We didn't holiday abroad. We holidayed in Dorset, and my mum and dad loved swimming in the sea. So it was just natural for them to take us to the sea to swim. And you know, we'd spend a couple of weeks in Dorset every summer holidays. We'd play in the sea. We'd build sandcastles. You know, really kind of British summertime holiday. And it wasn't until I got to university and we went to the coast one day, a group of us, and I was like, who's coming in? Everyone looked at me a bit like, really? No one, Ella. Like, and I, to be fair to them, it was probably about March time or April or something.
Pretty much the coldest
time. Yeah, but
I just
had it ingrained in me. If you went to the sea, you went in. I mean, even if you only put your toes in, it was just like part of the thing you did. And it was then I thought, oh, okay, so not everyone does this. And then I did that thing where I was in an office job Monday to Friday, and I was like looking for more because no one's really satisfied with just that. And then I decided to do a sea swim as like a charity sea swim. This is like back in like 2005, 2006. No one, like, people have been swimming outside for years, like decades, centuries. This isn't new. It's obviously having a bit of a trend at the moment. But there was a lull where it was seen to be dangerous, unclean, stupid to swim in the cold or outside. And I think sea swimmers have swam outside all year round for years and years and years. It's a very sort of traditional thing to do. But in the river and stuff like that, not so much. So I sort of did this. There wasn't many events around, but the British Heart Foundation put on a charity swim from the leisure centre in Hove towards the West Pier, and I didn't finish. At that time, I was a breaststroker. I could front crawl, but I was one of those people that would front crawl 25 metres in their leisure centre pool and then need a break, and then I'd be exhausted. I didn't finish this mile sea swim. I had to walk to the end, and I was mortified. And so I thought, well, if I'm going to do a bit more of this, maybe I should learn a better front crawl. And I literally went to my local leisure centre, found just one of their local teachers and said, would you give me an hour of your time? Obviously, I paid them. And, he was called Frank, and he was just like, well, you're doing everything wrong. You know,
thanks, Frank.
Your legs are a mess, and why do you only breathe on one side? I literally had that lesson. He said, you know what you're doing now, just go away and practice. And I would just swim lengths and lengths and lengths. And then the following year, British Heart Foundation did the Mile Sea Swim again, but this time it was in Weymouth, and I went and conquered it and then felt on top of the world.
Yes.
I started looking at lakes, and back then there weren't very many lakes offering swimming outdoors, but if they did, you had to be wetsuited up. I mean, hundreds of people use wetsuits. I think they're great, but I just never got on with them. You know, I'm a bigger woman. They weren't comfortable to put on. There's a really hideous story I could tell you about a woman in a change room helping me, bless her, to put one on. But she was naked.
What? Why?
She was half-dressed, and then I was struggling, and she was like, do you want some help? And I thought, well, I do, but...
Can you put something on?
Can you put your clothes on first? But I didn't. I was like, sure, help me. So there she is, like, with a bra on, but nothing else, like, pulling me at eye level to things and helping me into a wetsuit. I think that's probably scarred me for life.
Oh, I'm not surprised.
One of the things I enjoy is the feeling of the water, and it doesn't matter what body of water you're in, it's always going to be different. The salty or the brininess of an estuary, or, you know, I'd say it sometimes that the Thames is kind of silky because of the silt and stuff. You don't really get that if you're in a wetsuit.
It's very true, yeah.
You know, they're brilliant practical things, but I think to enjoy the water, I like being in just my cozy. And then just kind of I got into that addiction of, like, wanting to do colder, further, longer. And I was never fast, ever. But that was okay. I'm a strong swimmer now. I'm really confident and comfortable with my stroke. I've worked a lot on it. But I got to a point where I didn't want to do events anymore, unless they were different or unique. But obviously, the more I do and the more experience I get, the more I can kind of map out my own swims and do my own things, which is great. Because the events do come with a big price tag.
They are expensive.
They're really expensive.
Yeah. And it does change, it changes the experience of being in the water.
Absolutely.
It becomes more about getting from one place to another and not about just enjoying being in water. And I think more than any other thing, the experience of being sort of held by the water and being in the water is quite a special feeling. It's not, and sometimes you get it with running, but it's quite
fleeting.
Very fleeting. Like, oh, was that what they talk about? That nice feeling when you run. But it isn't, it's not really about that so much, but there's something quite elemental.
Yeah, no, that is a really nice way of putting it. And I think I was getting to the point where I'd go to the lake or I'd go down to the river and I'd feel like I was having to do, oh, I should probably knock out a couple of kilometres, otherwise what's the point? And I felt like I couldn't just go and lark about and then get out and eat a bit of cake. I felt like I had to be doing something, and I sort of, I almost lost my mojo a little bit as well. And then I started sort of doing my own personal sort of projects. Like, you know, a couple of years ago, I started doing swimming every single day of December.
Yes.
Dipper day December.
Yeah.
Because I'm not very good in the darker months. I'm an outdoor person. You know, I love the beauty of the longer days that daylight saving gives us in the summer. So it was forcing me to get outside, so to make a commitment. The first couple of days I was like, what the hell am I doing, this is hideous. And then, you know, sort of probably by the end of that week, I really started to feel the benefit and, like, that sense of accomplishment. Like, I'd get to work, I'd be like, yeah, I've already done a proper swim this morning. You know, winter can be quite isolating.
Yeah.
You know, we're more social in summer in the sense that, you know, we'll be like, let's pop to the pub for a couple of drinks, or it's a nice day, let's go for a walk and all that kind of thing. And suddenly when winter comes, everyone hunkers down and starts watching Strictly Come Dancing, and it can be a very isolating time. And actually forcing myself outside every day and then talking about it actually forced me to socialise with other people as well.
Have you progressively gotten more adventurous? Has it led you
definitely
to be a more adventurous person?
Yeah. 100%. I wasn't a girl guide. I didn't do any of that when I was younger. I did ballet lessons instead of that. I wasn't, you know, I didn't do the Duke of Edinburgh or anything like that. I really wasn't an outdoorsy person. I mean, ask my parents, they'd be like, you used to moan about going for a walk, and now I'm taking them for a walk, saying, there's this great waterfall up here. It's only another half an hour. I'm getting my own bad now.
So with Scotland, what was that about? Was that for a feature?
I'd been thinking about Scotland for a really long time, because I've been there for various different things at different points, and I always think, I should go back. You know, the amount of water, the coast, the locks, the rivers, the waterfalls, it's just a playground for swimmers. And I had this vision of me driving up the east coast of England, sort of wiggling across Scotland and coming down the west. And I was like, how long would that actually take to do? And I was aware of the fact, I'm not a camper. Like, when I was a kid, we went caravanning with my grandparents, but that was about it. And I hate sleeping in tents and pooing in the wild and all that kind of thing. I'm just too much of a... I like a decent bed and a decent loo. That's fair enough. But at the same time, I you know, the thought of parking up next to the sea and be able to just flop into it in the morning just was really appealing. And I've always liked the idea of having a camper. So yeah, I borrowed this camper. And there was also an awful lot going on at the time, and there still is, a massive conversation about women feeling unsafe. And I read this hideous article about women travelling on their own and how they should order two drinks at the bar to give the illusion that they're with someone else, which is nuts, because surely the barman's then going to watch that woman drink both drinks. Then she's going to be drunk as well as on her own. And I thought, what a bizarre advice to give. You know, like, if you order room service, ordering more than perhaps you... I was just thinking, this is getting a very expensive holiday. And I just thought, how sad that we feel that we can't. And I was like, we can. I mean, I know there are isolated incidences where bad things happen, and that's really awful. But I really sort of wanted to challenge the fact that I've done holidays on my own a lot, and I love it. It gives you sort of a different kind of perspective and brain capacity to when you travel with others. Mm-hmm. People approach you more when you're on your own, so you are more likely to meet new people and make new friends.
You're more receptive to that, yeah, as well, aren't you? When you're with someone, you kind of block off quite a lot of opportunities, yeah, I think, because you've got an easy option all of the time.
And also, you know, I would never necessarily just randomly go up to a couple and be like, hi, how are you doing? Are you enjoying your holiday? Because they'd be like, what are you doing? You know, like, having a romantic moment.
Why has she
got
two drinks?
Yes, exactly. Why is she eating two meals? And it was also quite interesting how, I don't know whether it's just a female thing, I think it is probably, but we're sort of taught to be afraid of others. So I did turn up one night. I didn't do much wild camping or anything like that, but there was this one spot, and it was an area that allowed overnight parking and camping. And you put a donation in this little pot for the upkeep of the loo block. And when I arrived, it was 10:30 at night, and there was like a long-haul lorry driver parked up. And of course, immediately I was like, well, he's going to kill me. He's an evil, horrible man, isn't he? You know, first of all, it could have been a woman in the truck. She had, you know, the curtains were drawn, that person was asleep. Second of all, it could have been a chap with a really lovely family, and he could have been the most friendly chap in the world. But of course, immediately I was like, that is a danger, even though there was no rational reason why it was. And I got the van ready within the confines of the van, because I didn't want to get out and show that I was on my own.
Do you have conversations with nobody?
Yeah.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah, you're going to put the roof up. It's a bit windy. You know, that kind of thing. You can't help but think, oh my gosh. You know, Scotland was about going on an adventure on my own and seeing what could happen, seeing how it felt. You know, what was I going to be afraid of, and what I did end up being afraid of. And the kind of things like loneliness and isolation and what came up. And it was a real adventure of sort of emotions and the soul, as much as it was exploring Scotland. And then, of course, there was the swimming, which was just magical.
With your writing, do you use that as your tool to encourage other people to get involved? Do you feel like that's almost how you can contribute? Because I know with this, I started making this because I felt like I'd found something that made me feel so alive and really connected by being outside in the way that you can engage with so many different things and what that brings to you. I was like, oh, I just want to see if I can spread the word a little bit. It's a bit evangelical, actually.
Yeah, spread the message.
Yeah. So that was a huge reason why I started doing this, and it's interesting to understand other people's drive for why they do.
Especially
when you don't own money, you know. Much
Money, I love people's stories and storytelling. So, you know, the more I swam, the more incredible people I met, either doing incredible things, like the chap who's just about to finish swimming around the entire coast of Britain.
And his tongue melted.
Yeah, you know, people like that. Or just the people who get up every day and just quietly swim you know, and you sort of see them. Like, we've seen a couple of people here today. On the beach, just sort of quietly getting on with it. You know, the range is huge, and everyone has a very unique and special story. And I love telling those stories through my writing. Someone said the other day, just follow the crumbs and you'll be okay. And I am. I just sort of, I found something I love, which is swimming. You know, I went to university, I did a writing and media degree, you know, and then I've just made it work. And I'm by no means doing financially well, but I am so happy, and it's the happiest I've been in a really long time, and my life is a lot richer for it, just for following the crumbs.
Just following the crumbs. I love that. That was Ella Foot, and you can find out more about her. She is online. She's got a really great online presence, actually, and she is at Ella Chloe Swims on Instagram and on Twitter, and she's always putting out really funny little Instagram story videos. She writes regularly for Outdoor Swimming magazine, so you can find her work there. That interview was longer than most. Again, really struggled to get that down because it was just, she made me laugh so much. And most of it actually is just me cracking up somewhere in the distance. But I'm probably going to put that out as well. I think I'm just going to put them both out as the full thing because they're so interesting. So thank you to the three wonderful women who are on this show, Zina, Tanya and Ella. Thank you for listening. You can get in touch with me on Instagram and Twitter at Growing Wild FM via the Radio Reverb webpage, which is radioreverb.com, and then search for Growing Wild in the shows. Or you can email growingwildreverb@gmail.com. I'm going to play you out with a song, and it's More Than This by Roxy Music. So until next time, go well, and thanks again for listening. I could